ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. On the Country Hour today, you'll hear from celebrity chef Maggie Beer, who is wondering why more of us don't eat offal.
Liver lamb's fry was such a special treat, and heart even. So, yes, I've been an offal person for way back.
Maggie Beer is an offal person. Did you chew into some offal over the Christmas period? Let me know, 0487 99 1057, the text number here at the Country Hour. Also this afternoon, an update on the floods through outback Queensland and a look at the work being done to get NT cattle wearing virtual fencing collars.
We have had 250 neckbands out this year across three different properties. It's worked on the cows, which is always a bonus, and it's been amazing. Yeah, really to use to see how it's been able to be integrated into our production system.
All these stories and plenty more coming up this afternoon on the Country Hour. Really hope you can stick around. We are broadcasting right across the territory on the ABC, and g'day there if you've tuned in via the podcast. It was a fairly quiet year for station sales in the Northern Territory, with only a handful of cattle stations actually changing hands. But 2025, well, the year definitely ended on a big high when the Beetaloo aggregation of stations in the Barkly region sold for $300 million plus the value of the herd. It was easily the largest pastoral sale in the Northern Territory's history. I had a chat to Frank Peacock from Heron Todd White for his thoughts on the significance of the Beetaloo sale and how it potentially sets up the property market in 2026.
It shows a fair bit of confidence in the industry, in the cattle industry. You know, we only had three other sales during the year in the NT and one in the Kimberley. And Beetaloo, you know, that one has been, you know, testing the market for a couple of years, and obviously, you know, the buyer has determined that that property is obviously key for them, a joining owner as well. There's a bit to know about Beetaloo as well, because it's such a, I guess, it's nearly unique, but in the way that it's been developed. So it's sort of the first one out of the blocks in terms of property that's predominantly fully developed. And yeah, the sale price, it sounds like there's a bit of work to do on the analysis, but it sounds like a price that tells you that CPC is very confident in the future of the cattle industry up here.
Yeah, so $300 million plus the value of the herd.
Mm.
What's 80,000-90,000 head of cattle worth at the moment?
It really does depend on the mix, but yeah, wouldn't know the exact answer to that until you look at the breakdown of the herd, but it's not the cheapest time to buy cattle, so yeah, it's going to be significant.
From the Country Hour records, it would seem this sale is easily the biggest pastoral station deal in the Northern Territory's history.
Yeah.
Australia-wide, where does this rate, do you think?
In terms of lump sum, I mean, there are others certainly up around that level, but for the NT, yep, two leases, definitely a record breaker. And I was just looking, Matt, at the last sale in the Barkley, which is something valuers always do to see, okay, what did the region last produce in terms of a sale? And that would have been Banker and Baran Chile back in, when was that, 2023?
That's when Gina Reinhart sold.
Yeah, Malcolm Harris bought that one. And so I've just done a bit of, you know, I'm on holidays, Matt, so I've sort of done a bit of the back of the envelope. But if you did strip it back to a dollar per AE, just fenced and watered, I think that the sale, this current one, is probably going to show like a 45% increase over that, two years, 8 months since Brunchilli. Brunchilli is a bit further south, a bit lighter rainfall, but very well-regarded property. So they're definitely in the same ilk. So that's 17% per annum over that period, over 2.75 years. on the Barkley. So like it's obviously so tightly held, and Beedaloo, like I said, adjoining owner sale, that generally, you know, gives the purchaser a reason to try and pick up, you know, they'll pay a bit more for some synergies. But also bordering that property, you had AACo and Kidman still, so it would have been, you know, it would have been sort of not direct competition, but if they didn't buy it one day, one of the others may have. So,
as in all the neighbours might have been kicking the tyres and running the probably, numbers at one stage. Yeah,
maybe. Yeah, yeah. And like I said, it's, you know, there aren't many stations that have been as well developed as Beedaloo. I mean, the same sort of members of the group did a similar sort of infrastructure project with Wal Hollow and also a Mungie Mungie. But yeah, it's a significant sale in the sense that, to me, when you look at the map, Beedaloo is 600 water points and it's nearly fully developed. And it's a test because they wanted to really get the utilization of pasture up. Traditionally on rangeland properties, you know, cattle might only eat 20% of the feed on the black country and maybe 5% on the red country. And it was always an aim, I think, for them to do the fencing and waters to try and increase that utilization. And I think they're quoting 90,000 head carrying capacity, which means that they've probably increased that utilization by, it's got to be 30% on the black country. So, we don't have the full details yet, but it signifies what development can do.
Yeah.
And CPC obviously going to have to, they would have done the numbers and they would have been convinced, I'd say, that it can't carry that, which means that it means that Beedaloo has got the utilization of those pastures to a level that you know, I guess you just never see on properties that aren't as intensely developed. Yeah.
And as you say, CPC has got the neighbouring country there at Newcastle Waters and Power Creek, Ten and Digi. And they're applying for water licences. It'll be fascinating to see what the next sort of 5-10 years looks like for that big chunk of what is now CPC land.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't know they were applying for the water licences. It's interesting. Yeah, I guess it really does depend on what kind of yields they're getting and what they're intending to do with it. Yeah, that will be interesting to watch.
Away from Beedaloo, you mentioned there was only three other station sales in the territory this year: Dorisvale, Murrinjoy, and what, Silkwood? Are they the three?
No, am I missing? No, Hodgson River.
Oh, yes, yeah,
yeah. So Dorisvale was first out of the blocks back in July. If you took the cattle offers back to $12 million for that property, and then they were, as you probably reported, some farmers / business people from Bathurst.
Yeah, the Schaefer family. Wales. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, interesting by profile. Murrinjoy was next, Viv Oldfield, $45 million. And it was that was a strong price as well. But I think the vendor had bought that property reasonably well a few years before as well. So it's probably, you know, Viv's a very obviously experienced cattleman, and he's bought property in the north as well. So, you know, I guess it's all convincing stuff when people of these profiles buy these properties. The last one was Hodgson River. That was in October. That was Mr. Bassingwaite. He's got Epinara down south of Tennant and also Central Queenslander. So, you know.
And he's got the Barkley homestead as well.
Does he? Oh, is he a shareholder in that?
He's involved in that, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Loves the territory, obviously.
Yeah. So where does this year rate in terms of station sales?
It's probably, in terms of numbers, it's probably about average. We've only got 220-odd leases in the NT, so only get a selection of them every year. Don't get big numbers. Normally get a sale or two in Alice, but there was none this year in the Alice, sort of anywhere south of Tennant Creek. There's no sales down there. A bit light on down there. There's still four or five on the market that have been, a couple of them been on there for a while. But I've heard, well, Claravale came on recently. The expressions of interest only just closed on that early in the month. And talking to the agents there, it sounds like they've got a fair bit of good interest there. Aruna's still on the market, but I've heard that that's getting some good inquiry more recently. Vermela still on, Neutral Junction still on, Ben Murray still on. So it's probably a typical year. There's always people, you know, testing the market, but it's, as a value, I love to see these things really well tested. And yeah, the odd one out of the box is obviously Beedaloo being such a big, big lump sum and such a different property in terms of how it's developed. So nothing too unusual. Always get a range of sales. There was one over in Kimberley as well, which is a region we cover, but Kalyeda, that just sold around October to the Emmanuel brothers who had Nerima nearby. So that was a good, healthy price as well. So, and with the abattoir selling over there as well, and word that maybe the Livingston abattoir is getting looked at. I don't know. I just got a feeling that when things were a little bit quiet over the last 18 months, I just think there's a few little green shoots there, and I just think the strength of the cattle industry is going to spur a few more sales. I predict there might be a few more sales in the next 6 months, actually.
That is Frank Peacock, who is a rural valuer with Heron Todd White, taking a look back at the year that was for cattle station sales in the Northern Territory. So as you mentioned, Doris Vale, Murrinjay, Hodgson River, all changing hands. And then the big one, the record breaker, the Beedaloo aggregation of stations, selling for $300 million plus the value of the herd. That was a big story. If you missed our coverage earlier in the month, you can find our article on the NT Country Hour website. It is 19 to 1. Did you eat some offal over the Christmas period? Are you frying up some this afternoon? Let me know. Got one text here that says, tripe is wonderful when cooked well. Celebrity chef Maggie Beer thinks we should all be hooking into some more offal. She'll be on your radio next.
Hello, I'm Sona Madikari Rana. I'm CDO graduate, working as a technical officer in Native Rice Project. I love this job because there are so many opportunities to learn. Enjoy listening to Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. You are tuned into the Country Hour. We've only got two shows left for 2025. Well, it's backed by celebrity chef Maggie Beer and researchers, but why aren't we eating more offal in this nation? Made up of animal organs and high in iron and other essential nutrients, experts believe the benefits of offal have been overlooked for too long. Claudia Sullivan takes a look.
It might seem unappetizing or even gross to some, but experts say shoppers looking for a nutritious boost in their diet should consider offal. One Australian who fondly remembers offal-based meals like sheep's brain fry is celebrity chef and health advocate Maggie Beer.
I grew up eating offal as a child as my favourite food, except for tripe. The pleasure of tripe happened much later in life. But it was the first thing I ever cooked was offal. It was chicken livers. But we, as a family, we would have brains and sweetbreads and liver. Lamb's fry was such a special treat. And heart even. So, yes, I've been an offal person for way back. One of the great things is brains. I had a pheasant farm restaurant. And it was a game restaurant, but for entrees, I would use a lot of offal and a lot of vegetable dishes. But when I had brains on, they would sell out. I'd never have enough to satisfy the day's choice from the customers, usually men who loved it, but their wives wouldn't cook it. So they're so easy to cook. And from a recipe point of view, is poaching the brains and then letting them chilled and then cooking them in nut brown butter with capers and parsley and a good squeeze of lemon. And that, to me, is one of the great dishes of the world.
I mean, the earliest memory you talked about, do you remember the first time you ate it?
Well, I remember the first time I cooked it, rather, and ate, and I know that stuck in my memory because I know I was pan-frying chicken livers. I was seven, and my father said, stop picking at those, there'll be none left for anyone else. So that's my first real memory of offal. But we used to also, we would have brawn and pig's ears, you know, anything. It was a total respecting of an animal by using every part of an animal.
Australia exported 234,000 tonnes of edible offal in 2024, according to Meat and Livestock Australia. And even in Rockhampton, Australia's beef capital, there are still loyal consumers of sheep's brain. Bill Douglas is a local butcher, and he works long days to procure their mostly locally sourced products, including animal organ meat.
That'll do. He sold it mostly to elderly people. Obviously, because they grew up with it, it's something they're still looking for and remember. They come in just for it. If we don't have it, we've ran out, we make sure we have it later on in the week for them and they'll come back for it. It's getting harder and harder to get less places actually selling it. A few young people get the liver because they want the iron. So we have had a few people get the lamb's fry because of the high iron content.
Veterinarian and Australian National University Honorary Professor Robin Alders has been researching food and nutrition security for over 30 years. With almost no research conducted in Australia, she believes the potential of offal is often undervalued.
For earlier generations, the consumption of organ meat was very common. If you think about traditional recipes like steak and kidney pie, and it's still regularly used in more resource-limited settings. So our diet has drifted, we're consuming a lot of junk food, and we're eating only the muscle. So that gives us a certain range of nutrients. But if you then look at products such as kidney, liver, heart, or the brain, each of those have a particular profile, and they're often very high in key vitamins, minerals, and the good fatty acids. We live in a world where there's an increasing percentage of people who are malnourished. Let's take, for instance, women of reproductive age. What data tells us in Australia is that around 25% of pregnant women in Australia are anemic, and in many cases, this anemia is caused due to iron deficiency anemia. So organ foods such as liver, very high in iron. And the important thing is that the iron in animal source food, in liver, is what we call bioavailable. So it's in a form that the body can use immediately, which means you get good uptake and good utilization. And one of the problems is that even globally, if you look at the Food and Agricultural Organization, the data that gets submitted from countries focuses on muscle. And it's something that they are actively trying to change right now, so that organ meats are also reported, because everyone's aware now that our system is hemorrhaging nutrients if we're not taking organ meat into account.
That is Robin Alders from the Australian National University speaking to Claudia Sullivan about the joys and the deliciousness of offal. Text here from Carl in the Do, who says, on the subject of offal, love most of it, but I find tripe difficult to find. I regularly get chicken hearts, though. Yummy. Cheers and all the best for the new year, says Carl in the Do this afternoon. Yeah, I feel like I saw chicken hearts for sale in one of the major supermarkets the other day. So offal's even in the major supermarkets, but tripe, yeah. I can't remember going into any store of recent years and seeing tripe for sale. But if it's there, I'm keen.
Join the ultimate party this New Year's Eve across the ABC with a massive lineup, including Melanie C, plus the famous Sydney Fireworks, audio described on the ABC Listen app.
Happy New Year!
On ABC TV and iView and the ABC Listen app.
Right across the territory on the ABC, you are tuned into the Country Hour. Cyclone Hayley, a Category 3 cyclone, is now getting very close to the WA coastline. Up next, I'll be taking you to a pearl farm that at the moment's in the direct path of this system.
G'day, James McKenna here from Tipperary Station, running the lemon operation here, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Yeah, Pearl Farm in the Kimberley at the moment is in the direct path of Cyclone Hayley, which is currently a Category 3 cyclone and is expected to hit the WA coast north of Broome later on today. It's a very anxious wait for Pearl Farmer James Brown. He's at Cygnet Bay at the top of the Dampier Peninsula. He spoke a moment ago to our reporter Jess Baker. Let's have a listen.
I'm feeling pretty anxious, to be honest, at this stage. Look, the preparation's pretty much been done days ago, weeks ago, really. We started preparing for the cyclone season pretty early this year with the first low that was kicking around quite early in the season. So, this time of year, we pretty much spend a lot of our time kind of packing up the cyclones and getting ready, and then obviously most of the time, or almost every time, they miss you, and then you unpack, and so that's the cycle. But yeah, we're kind of always in a state of readiness. But the closer they get, and certainly when they've got this type of consistency in the track that's coming straight for Cape Levique, which will at this stage looks like it's going to go right on top of Cape Levique and Cygnet Bay. Yeah, the closer you get, the more anxious you get, really.
Is this anxiety something you've experienced before? Have there been cyclone paths where Cygnet Bay is in the path like it is currently?
Yeah, look, you always get a little anxious when there's cyclones kicking around, especially with so many, so much of our investment in the water, in long lines and all the rest of it. It's, it's always a bit nerve-wracking, let alone all of the infrastructure we've got on the, on the land as well. But we've had plenty of cyclones, obviously, buzzing around us in the past, and I've had a few go over the top of us. I've been in the eye of some cyclones at Cygnet Bay, but at the same time, all they got to do is miss you by 50 or 100 kilometres, and it's only a strong storm. So usually you get anxious, and then as it gets closer and closer, normally they don't often end up giving you a direct hit, but this one seems to be really steady on its path. So even though it's not going to happen until tonight, certainly looks like everyone on the tip of the peninsula needs to prepare themselves for that direct hit this time, I reckon.
For anyone listening who isn't aware, what does a Pearl Farm actually look like? What's there, and what could potentially get damaged in this cyclone?
Crikey. A Pearl Farm is essentially lots of long lines in the water where we've got like 200 or 300 metre lines that are anchored at both ends with tons of weight as anchors, and then they're held to the surface by floats, and then we hang our pearl shell and panels underneath them, and that's how we grow or cultivate the pearls, or the pearl shell and the pearls, for a couple of years. So yeah, it's multi-year production system. So you engineer everything, obviously, to withstand severe storms. And this isn't the first time we've obviously had impacts like this. Fingers crossed, our farm should be okay. But we've got a lot of infrastructure on the land as well. I mean, in fact, next year marks 80 years of us being in the pearling industry. So Cygnet Bay is. Cygnet Bay's evidence of that. Anyone that's been there, you can see all the sheds and houses and everything else have slowly kind of grown over many, many, many decades. So yeah, there will be damage. There's no doubt about that. It's just a matter of kind of how much and how severe. And fingers crossed, everything we've done leading up to it minimises that, so we can get back to work.
Obviously, like you said, your family's been in this business for a while now. My understanding is you've been farming South Sea pearls north of Broome for three generations, and that would make you no stranger to threats like these. So have past cyclones changed the way that you get ready now? I imagine you've got a kind of routine down pat at this point.
We do, but we've got a lot of people and a lot of assets and a lot of different things to deal with. We've got more farms these days as well. We've got leases off Broome and around that area, and we've got boats and people based down there as well. So, a cyclone pack up for us is kind of spread across about 300 kilometres and, 50 to 100 people involved and lots of different assets getting put away. Some of the bigger boats have to go on cyclone moorings. So some of our 20, 24 metre vessels, they're on cyclone moorings. The smaller boats, so anything that's sort of, 10 to 12 metres. We try and pull out of the water. You know, those are boats of up to sort of 10, 20 tonnes. So, you know, there's a fair bit of effort that goes into actually trying to mitigate for these cyclones. And then, of course, once it passes, then you've got to go and do everything in reverse. So, yeah, it takes a fair effort to get a fleet packed up and then redeployed.
Yeah, of course.
But we've got great people up there, and they've done their jobs and are well prepared. So it's really just a matter of waiting now. But you know, we've got lots of people around us on the peninsula as well, at Ardealun and Juddajin, and all the way down to Beagle Bay and all the outcamps. So fingers crossed. You know, I see that the Juddajin's trying to evacuate people now. Well, I think they said before 9 a.m. So you need to get as many people off the peninsula as possible at this stage and to Broome. We've got minimal people left up there. Everybody's obviously kind of asked or invited to leave, so most have, except there's only three people left on site, and they're all prepared to climb into the cyclone shelter if things get to that point.
Yeah, there are many components to this. You're worried about your business and equipment, but also the people. So I imagine it's a pretty frightening waiting game right now.
Yeah, the peninsula hasn't had the tip of the peninsula hasn't had a direct hit from a severe cyclone for a long, long time. So, yeah, there's a lot of people up there now, you know, like I say, one arm point and whatnot, and they're pretty exposed. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we've got the local police up there doing their thing and coordinating with DFES, and, you know, we're in communication with them all the time, and, you know, they do a great job. But, yeah, I hope people that can't remember actually going through one listen to the warnings and get out, rather than thinking this is, you know, some type of adventure to experience.
That's James Brown of Cygnet Bay Pearl Farm speaking to Jess Baker a moment ago, wishing James, his family and the whole team there at Cygnet Bay all the best. So Cyclone Hayley, it's a Category 3 system. Sustained winds near the centre of 155 kilometres an hour, wind gusts of up to 220 k's an hour. At the moment, it's located about 200 kilometres to the northwest of Broome and is expected to pass pretty much where that Pearl Farm is later on tonight. We can ask the Weather Bureau more about that in a moment, but first, let's head to the newsroom. It's 1 o'clock on your ABC.
Charles Vaughan here, Australian Cattle Enterprises and Charles Vaughan Veterinary Services, are here today at Berrima Export Yards, and you're listening to The Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. In a moment, a trip over into outback Queensland to get an update on the flooding and the welfare of livestock in that region. And before 1:30, we'll also be looking at the work being done to get NT cattle wearing virtual fencing collars.
We have had 250 neckbands out this year across three different properties. It's worked on the cows, which is always a bonus. And it's been amazing, yeah, really, to use to see how it's been able to be integrated into our production system.
And we're hearing from you this afternoon. Our text number is 0487 991057 in regards to our earlier story about offal and how Maggie Beer reckons we need to be eating more of it. One text message here was asking the question, was there a tripe club in Darwin? And then all of a sudden I've got another message from John in Karama who said, Darwin had a tripe club until COVID killed it. We hope to get it going again soon. John says, Rick Hind from the ABC came along on lunchtime one day, but didn't try the fare. Ah, John, if you get the tripe club up and going again, don't call Rick, call the Country Hour. I'll be there with bells on and a fork ready to go. And a big thanks to Carl in the Do, who has been checking out the levels of Darwin River Dam.
Damn!
And he's right, it's close. It's very close to overflowing. Not quite there yet, according to Power and Water. Darwin River Dam, this afternoon, the capacity is sitting at 99.7%. It's close. Is there some rain coming soon to make it spill over? Let's go to the Weather Bureau now. Rebecca Patrick's there this afternoon. How are you, Beck?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you, Matt.
Darwin River Dam doesn't need too much more water to get it going over the spillway. What's the story?
Yeah, well, there is. Well, right there at the moment looks like a bit of a shower on the radar. Probably some heavier showers further up to the northwest of them. But, yeah, a few showers and storms forming around the rural area at the moment, and broadly across the top end as well, probably more likely in the western and northern parts of the top end today. So, yeah, maybe. I'm not sure how much rainfall it needs to get over that edge, but, yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, and just looking at the radar now, all this moisture is sort of coming in directly from the west, it would seem.
Yeah, so we've got still got those westerly winds. As we go into New Year's Eve, so tomorrow night and the subsequent days, we get that westerly wind through a bit more depth. So, yeah, we'll start to see perhaps a bit more shower activity on the coast. I haven't seen a lot of that the last couple of days. Mostly has been inland, but, yeah, maybe in coming days we'll see a bit more coastal showers.
Okay. Speaking of the west, what is the latest on Cyclone Hayley?
Yeah, so I guess the good news is it's showing signs of weakening a little bit. So it was a Category 4. It's now back to Category 3. And, yeah, as you mentioned earlier, heading towards that northwest part of the Kimberley, so towards that Cape Leveque area, and expected to cross tonight.
Mm. And has it got enough power that if it keeps punching, you know, inland, could it bring moisture into the Northern Territory?
At this stage, it's looking like it'll stall before getting into the Northern Territory. So going inland over the Kimberley, there will be a trough across the territory though. So through that Gregory District, so certainly we'll see a bit of an increase in shower and storm activity through that area over the coming days, with a chance of some heavier falls through there as well. Probably not so much today. There is a chance of showers and storms through there, but probably picking up over the next few days.
Just looking at the daily rainfall bulletin, well, for this time of year, it's pretty quiet today. You know, Fish River Station got 15 millimetres, Fanny Creek 12, Upper Waterhouse 11, but yeah, pretty quiet. And as for the flood warnings, it looks like everything's sort of easing. Is that fair to say, Beck?
Yeah, that's right. So we did have that flood warning for the MacArthur River at Borroloola that was finalised today. It didn't quite get to that minor flood level, got to about 8.7 metres. The minor flood level is 9 metres. So that was good news for residents there. Generally over the next few days, not seeing too heavy falls, maybe parts of the top end. Tomorrow, sort of inland parts could see some heavier falls, and then, as I mentioned, maybe in the Gregory District around Thursday, Friday. But apart from that, nothing too heavy at this stage.
Okay, and we're about to hear from a cattle producer near Julia Creek in outback Queensland about all the rain and the wind that region's been getting. What's your understanding of the next 24, 48 hours over there? Is it going to improve for these producers, or is it going to keep on raining and be dangerous for them?
Yeah, certainly today, tomorrow, still seeing some reasonable rainfall. Generally, will be easing off, but, yeah, still a bit of rain around for today and tomorrow.
Okay, no worries. And out of interest, are you a fan of offal?
Can't say I've had it.
I must admit, I have texted my mum saying, "Mum, did you cook up tripe for us back in the day? Because I can't remember it. We used to kill our own beasts on the farm, but I can't remember tripe and other bits and bobs." I've learned today that there was a tripe club in Darwin, and someone else says, "I joined the tripe club once at Berry Springs Pub. It was yum." On other food matters, Haggis says, if the dam, Darwin River Dam, is going to go over, get the cherubin pots ready.
Ooh.
Yummy. All right, there's a bit going on. Beck, thanks so much for your time.
No worries. Thank you.
It is 13 past one and you are tuned into the Country Hour. I'm loving the offal texts. I'm loving the cherubin texts. Keep them coming. 0487991057. Let's go across the border, where strong winds and constant rain have made it pretty hard for cattle producers in northwest Queensland to actually get out and check how their stock are doing over the recent days. And today's forecast, not looking that good over there. Heavy rain is expected, and there's a lot of cattle producers concerned about the welfare of their stock. Patrick Hick is from Argyle Station near Julia Creek. He says they've had more than 420 millimetres of rain over the last week or so, and he is desperate for a change in the weather.
Yesterday was a pretty tough day, continuous rain, big wind, 60-kilometre-hour wind most of the day, very tough on livestock. I think livestock would have been okay yesterday, and look, by the end of today, if we don't see the wind drop right off and the wind and the rain stop, if we don't see an improvement in the weather today, it's going to be really tough on livestock. They'll probably be right until late this afternoon, but if they've got to go through another tough night, that's going to be really hard.
And, you know, in terms of the forecast and what you are expecting from today, what are you seeing? What are you thinking today might be like?
I'm hoping that it is going to ease today, so the forecast is hinting at that, but, you know, it's a forecast for a region. What it will actually do it in our specific location is just, it's hard to say.
And you mentioned there that, you know, you've been dealing with some pretty tough conditions. Obviously, the non-stop rain, the strong winds, it's been too wet and too tough to be able to really get out and check on your stock. But, you know, do you have any idea on how the stock might be faring at the moment?
We're only able to see the stock that are very close to the homestead, and that's not many of them. Yesterday, they were faring okay, but by the end of the day, it would have been starting to tell on them. My feeling is they would be okay until this evening, coming up this Tuesday evening, but if they've got to go through another tough night, they're probably going to start running out of energy, and when they start running out of energy, they start bogging in the black soil.
Right, and that's obviously what you're wanting to avoid. And we spoke yesterday briefly, and you said, you know, the only reprieve here is that it wasn't cold necessarily where you are. Has that changed at all with that, you know, the wind's a little bit slower, but have the temperatures dropped overnight or you know, how are things looking in that space?
The temperature has not changed significantly. I was in weather yesterday afternoon and it was a bit cooler out there, but it was not dangerously cool. So then the temperature does not feel to have dropped significantly today, and the wind has dropped a little, so that all helps. It hasn't got worse, I feel. We'd really like to hope that we saw the heaviest of it yesterday, but we probably haven't, but we really need it to have eased off by this afternoon.
How is it looking at Argyle where you are? What's the situation with flooding?
Look, flooding is not going to affect us as much as just exposure issues for livestock. So obviously it's very limited what we can see. We're stuck at the homestead. No one can fly. I know creeks are up high, but flooding is not the issue for us so much. It's just environmental conditions for livestock. Now, the one thing that is going, we have got going for us flooding-wise a little bit, is the creeks and river systems were empty when they started. It's not like they were full already. So that's going to help a little bit, but will change fairly quickly. It's the exposure and the boggy black soil conditions are going to be more of a factor for us here than the actual flooding. But as you move further down the river systems, flooding becomes more of an issue then.
That is Patrick Hick from Argyle Station near Julia Creek in northwest Queensland speaking to Maddie McCosker. It is 17 past one on yesterday's Country Hour. You heard from a cattle producer in New South Wales who was using virtual fencing collars on his livestock, and he was pretty happy with the outcomes. But could this technology work and be viable in the Northern Territory? Up next, a look at what has been done in the north.
G'day, I'm Gavin Howie from Turf NT out at Middle Point. Welcome to the Country Hour.
It is now legal in all states and territories to put virtual fencing collars onto cattle. And in southern parts of this nation, the waiting lists for this technology is growing. There's a lot of people keen to get onto this. The Northern Territory was actually one of the first jurisdictions to allow for trials of virtual fencing collars. That was allowed back in 2019. But as Fiona Broom reports, researchers are still trying to find out if this technology can work and be viable on remote NT cattle stations.
So this is our Gallagher eShepherd virtual fencing collar. Pretty functional piece of equipment here, very high tech.
Virtual fencing systems are now legal in states and territories right across Australia. But there's one big question that hangs over the north. Will virtual fences work in extensive beef production systems? Livestock scientist Dr. Christy Pearson has been running virtual fencing trials with Brahman cattle at the Katherine Research Station.
It's about 2 kilos. We've got our solar panels. We've got our neck band here with a soft rubber at the top that sits over the top of the neck. And we've got our chains down the side, which give the animal the pulse.
So the collar is just one part of the tech that creates the virtual fence. What are the other elements?
Yeah, so there's two collars. The cellular collars are standalone items, and you can basically, if you've got cellular reception where your cows are, you can use the cellular collars and they connect directly to the service provider. If you don't have service where your cows are going to be, then you're going to need to get the LoRa collars, which basically connect to a base station that's within sort of line of sight of the collars. So depending on your country type and your paddock size and how thick, you know, vegetation is, you put up different numbers of towers. The guys at eShepherd map that all out for you. So, yeah, it's a pretty straightforward process. The base stations are really simple to set up. We got it down to about an hour and a half to set up our base stations in the paddock. They're on a 6 metre, I think around 6 metre tripod, and they've just got a gateway, battery, solar panel, and yeah, that's how the collars connect to the gateway. And then our gateways have a Starlink, which is a standalone setup next to the gateway, and they're connected straight through to a Starlink. So that's how we get all our comms through.
You're expanding the research side of this at the Territory Research Stations for 2026, but you've already done a bit of work with these collars. What are some of the challenges that you've found working with these?
Yeah, so we've had a really promising year this year. We've been kind of, I suppose, going in a bit slow in terms of making sure we understand the technology and that, you know, the cattle are happy with it, and they've come back in with no issues. We have had 250 neck bands out this year across 3 different properties. I think some of the challenges for us are going to be getting all the collars out. To actually collar an animal is a little bit more tricky than, you know, doing your standard husbandry procedures. So the volume of collars that you put out is going to impact the amount of effort that you've got to put in. So we can collar 100 head in, you know, a couple of hours, and that's kind of making sure that everything's fitted really well. We have a bit of a process for how we check, you know, how tight the collars are and make sure they're working and all that sort of stuff. So I'm sure that, you know, with more experience there, we can streamline that process further.
Using virtual fences in the Northern Territory, even just a couple of years ago, would have seemed like science fiction. Is it a real possibility now that this could be rolled out at stations in the north?
I've worked with a few different technologies for cattle in the past 10 years, and, you know, some of them are more disappointing than others. This one's done really well. We're really pleased with how it's done what it said it's going to do. It's worked on the cows, which is always a bonus. And it's been amazing yeah, really to use to see how it's been able to be integrated into our production system. So I think it's a really exciting time to be involved with cattle and tech at the moment, and the next 5 to 10 years is really promising. And yeah, I'd watch this space for sure because it's only going to get better.
What is the prospect for how virtual fencing could change farming systems in the north?
I think everyone is going to have a different idea or objective for how this is going to work for their property. Everyone sort of has, you know, focuses that they're wanting to look at with their cattle, or certain management practices that they're wanting to implement. So the virtual fencing is really versatile because you can pretty much do anything that you can think of. You can see where all your animals are pretty much all the time in real time. You can move your animals wherever you want, however you want, whenever you want. The flexibility to do that from the comfort of the aircon on the app is, you know, I mean, that's what, you know, we all kind of dream about, isn't it? Moving cattle while you're sitting listening to the Country Hour.
A new research project being led by Charles Darwin University and the CSIRO will test whether virtual fences can be effective if cows, but not their calves, are collared. CDU Associate Professor Dr. Beth Penrose says the differences between regional farming systems will be put under the microscope.
So virtual fencing is used a lot in southern Australian systems and in New Zealand, particularly in dairy systems and in more intensive beef systems. It's a bit different here because the size of the property is just so massive. We have a lot more set stocking. We put our cows out and then we might not see them for 6 to 12 months. And so that makes quite a lot of difference, but also provides us with these amazing opportunities to be able to control grazing better over these massive paddocks. Most people's paddocks are very, very large, you know, 1,000 to 2,000 hectares, something like that, which down south might be the entire property or maybe even bigger than the entire property. And so it's giving us this amazing opportunity to be able to manage grazing better in these really extensive systems. So this project will be looking at what happens when you collar the cow in terms of, does the cow respect the fence still, even though her calf might be over the fence? Does the calf respect the fence at all? Do they know from their mums, oh, actually, don't go in there? What happens in terms of behaviour and welfare? So does it really distress either the cow or the calf and therefore may be a bit problematic for using it long term? We just don't have any idea about any of that stuff. No one's really ever done it. That's what we're looking at, because these are the really important questions that we need to be able to answer if we're going to do that on a large scale in the north, because that's most of our systems.
Is it something that you could see being used right across a station, or is it more likely virtual fencing is used for moving cattle in particular areas or for protecting particular areas?
I think there's nothing particularly stopping anybody apart from money from doing it on the whole station, potentially. It's just much more difficult to do over very large areas, and to collar, you know, 20 to 80,000 cows is a lot of animals. And so probably in the first instance to use it on particular areas where you really want to keep them out of somewhere or you really want to keep them in somewhere, and then see what happens. I also see some massive potential co-benefits. So say you're doing it for, you know, the protection of a river system or a water course or whatever. Yeah, that's one use of it, and that might really help protect that area for either biodiversity or for water quality or whatever you're trying to do. But also, you know where your cattle are. So when you are mustering with a helicopter, the helicopter pilot can have that on their phone, can know exactly where the cows are, and that's a bit of a game changer, if I'm honest.
Where's the drive coming from to look into the viability of a virtual fencing system in the north?
I think virtual fencing has been talked about a lot in northern beef in general and in the Northern Territory included in that. People have been quite sceptical about it for quite a while, and that's fair enough. There's certainly past iterations of the technology were not suited to the north. I think we're getting there. But producers now, when you talk about it, are really excited about it. I think often if they think that researchers think it's probably going to be all right, then they can have a little bit more confidence. Although I have to say, you know, very understandably and very wisely, they're looking to see what happens. And so it's really important that we be able to test it and be able to give industry some really great answers about what happened.
Back at the research station, Dr. Christy Pearson says there's plenty of curiosity about virtual fencing in the northern beef industry.
Yeah, definitely. There's been a lot of interest from producers in the region, even if it's not like a direct going to implement immediately on their property kind of interest. It's a what could this mean for me in the future? You know, producers are good at looking forward in the next 5 to 10 years when this technology has been refined even further. What sort of impact could that have on their management, you know, if their business, and how can they overcome the challenges that they've got now by using this technology? I think, as I said before, like everyone's going to have a different objective. And I think if you have a clear objective with what you want and you think that this can help you, it's a pretty amazing technology. And yeah, we're always happy to, you know, chat to producers, give us a call, happy to share, you know, what we've learnt and help you along the way.
That is Dr. Christy Pearson at the Katherine Research Station speaking to Fiona Broom about virtual fencing. And you also heard from Dr. Beth Penrose from Charles Darwin University.
Keep your garden growing strong with ABC Organic Gardener magazine. Inside you'll find summer pruning advice, organic pest solutions, and our expert guide to eggplants at newsagents or abcmagazines.com.au.
A big shout out to everyone at Borroloola this afternoon. There's been minor flooding in the MacArthur River this week, but according to the Bureau, river levels have now peaked and are expected to remain below that minor flood level. So everything easing there at the MacArthur River. There's a flood watch still in place for parts of the Barkly and Carpentaria catchments, but again, everything is easing. There's a few scattered showers and storms across the top end as we go to air this afternoon. The big weather story sits on either side of us, I guess. Cyclone Hayley is approaching the Kimberley coast, is expected to cross later on this evening. And over in outback Queensland, a lot of cattle producers getting very nervous about the strong winds and constant rain. Hope you can join us tomorrow for the last country hour of 2025. We'll be taking a look back at the year that was for live cattle exports, and we'll be counting down the top five stories of the year here at the Country Hour. What did you click on in 2025? I'll tell you tomorrow. Until then, bring back the Tripe Club and keep it rural.